Welcome back to Talk Talk Nation. I'm your host, Joe Weber, and I'm sitting with one of the best in the business, Mr. Spike Ferriston.
Yes.
Is that how I pronounce your name? So did I?
You should have asked that before we started. I know. But right, yeah, you got it right. You did it. You did well.
Cool.
Yeah.
Spike, thank you so much for letting us film in your garage. I know this has been kind of a hectic morning. We did Spike's
You did my
car
show.
Radio.
Yeah. You guys were great.
Thank you.
You were fantastic. No one was here. We had a good time, right?
It was great. Yeah. I had a lot of fun. It's been a while since I've commented on like topical stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So it's cool to be like, what do you think of the Ferrari Luce?
And
unload a little bit.
Yeah. Good. Yeah. I'm glad. Yeah. That was fun.
Yeah. Well, like I said, Spike's Car Radio is like probably the podcast that I listen to the most relating to cars. You've kind of set the standard for like topical stuff and, you know, fun, irreverent banter.
Oh,
that's
nice to hear. Somebody's listening.
A ton of people probably.
That's cool.
But I want to talk about your background because you didn't initially, you weren't, you know, into cars, car media initially.
No, not at all. But, you know, it was weird. At one point, I was really obsessed with cars in my 30s. And I asked my mom, I go, you know, how did I get here?
Yeah.
You know, is this a relatively new phenomenon? And she said, no, since the age of 2.
Oh.
I go, really? And she sent me a picture of some, like, you know, little album she kept, her journal, and it said obsessed with cars. And then there were, you know, 3 and 4 drawing cars. Yeah. And it was, you know, it was just reassuring to see that this wasn't just some new thing that happened.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
Like
that
it
was
bones.
Just, it's kind of the way everybody is, I think, that it was just something. I see it happen all the time. Like now I'm driving, I might be driving a cool press car, like a Gunther Works recently, and I go by a school or playground or something, and there's a kid, and you see him grab his mom like that, and look, and you see that little light turn on.
Yeah.
You know, and you go, oh, there's one of our tribe. That's
I'm
one
seeing
of those
that
people.
With my kid right now, who's almost 2, who his first word was car. I was like, I'm not going to force my hobbies onto him.
Yes.
I'm going to let him discover stuff.
True.
And first thing he did was start spinning wheels. And then his first word was car. And now he's just obsessed with them.
Good news, bad news.
Yeah.
At 2, it may not last.
Yeah.
My son, you're reminding me, my son's second word was Ferrara. Ferrara? And then, whenever I was alone with him, I was like, oh, this is going to be really fun and really upsetting to my wife. And then I said, the Porsche? Porsche? And I started having him do Alfa Romeo. And he was just like, you got to stop because he was doing, it was mama and then, and then right into Ferrari, Porsche, and Alfa
De
Romeo.
Tommaso?
It was so fun. But now he's, he flies and he plays lacrosse and he likes to DJ.
What do you mean by he flies?
He's a pilot. He started flying. Wow. Well, he's on his way to becoming one. He started flying when he was 13.
Whoa.
Everything kind of changed. Like it was, you know, the car track and the flying pilot track were the same. So, you know, I would have said the same thing the older pilots said, which is if they're still obsessed at 12, then it's a lifelong thing.
Yeah.
And the car thing kind of faded. I mean, he likes BMWs and he works on the show and stuff, but the pilot thing was just like,
that,
you know,
was
just intensified
obsession
at 12. So getting back to 2 years old,
yeah,
you won't know. And you can't, by the way, you can't force them to.
Oh, for sure.
It won't matter. They'll just become kind of immune to it and go, okay, yeah, dad, yeah, whatever, Gunther Works, 1.6 million. You know, they're just like, whatever.
Yeah. Well, that's, it's like Hogwarts schools. Like your toddler gets into planes, cars, or dinosaurs.
And then they're set. Or Pokemons.
Pokemon,
yeah, or things like that.
You mentioned Gunther Works. Did you drive the, 1,100 horsepower?
I just drove the F26.
That's the silver one that's modeled after
the slant nose, which is wild. You know, It's wild. I mean, it's really, they're beautiful creations. They're making 26 of them. They're ungodly fast. I mean, Peter called me up and said, no one's driving it in comfort mode. And then I drove it in comfort mode. And I went, Peter, there's nothing comfortable about comfort mode. There's just like death, near death, you know, acceleration.
Yeah.
He goes, ha, 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 just laughs. But they're wonderful and they're a specific kind of buyer. And there's a car for everyone, really. Mm-hmm. And that car is for the people who like to have something that feels like a track ready car that's blindingly fast, uniquely kind of styled on the exterior, bespoke all around.
Yeah.
But not exactly right for the street. You know?
I don't think it's at home on the street.
Yeah.
I drove the turbo, the orange one.
Yeah.
And I was scared shitless. And he was like, Peter actually drove me around in it and was like, you know, like peeling out in third gear going 65. And I'm like, who needs more power than that?
It's just a specific kind of guy. And a few years ago, we picked one, the Skunk Works, I think, car that he built, the one that Peter crashed in at Willow, as our car of the year. It was, you know, it's an amazing car, and it really was fun, and it was thrilling, and it was different, and it's unique. I mean, you know, all of these cars have specific buyers that can tell you about why they buy them or not. But when you get in, even the Singers, you get into these big dollar cars that most of us can't afford, and I'll put myself in that category. You know, it's fun for a week, and then you get to the stuff you can drive and like and afford. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Is that a bird?
Probably.
Or a cat?
There's seagulls.
Oh, okay. That makes sense.
On the roof. Zuckerman throws his chicken bones up there when he's done.
How is it sharing a garage with Zuckerman? Like, you guys are selling cars out of here as well, right?
This, you know, the show, some of our cars are here together. Yeah. We have Plan Z. We own cars together. But this is primarily Zuckerman space. I just took that little corner where there used to be a couch and put the studio there so we could look over our shoulders at cars. But Zuckerman's very laid back, like I am. You know, the reason people ask us all the time, how do you share cars between years? We forget that we've even done it as frequently. And that's it. The only rule I think we have is if you're driving it and you f*** it up, you just go fix it and then put it back. And put it back wherever, in my hangar, his hangar, or other places, with gas in it.
And I was surprised to find out that you don't have any like written agreement with him. You just kind of, it's verbal.
If he dies, I'm going to lose a lot of money. And he could die any minute. Yeah. There's no paper trail.
That's real trust.
Hey, or stupidity. If you know anything about lawyers, they, you know, they're the last ones to have wills or any sort of contracts. They make everybody else do it, and then they don't do it at all. But
When I worked with a bunch of nurses, like I said, I worked at the old folks home.
Yeah.
There's a bunch of nurses and all of them smoked. And I was like, aren't you the ones that tell us not to smoke?
What? Yes, exactly right. Yeah. No, I know.
Yeah.
That's interesting. You should do a podcast about that.
About nurses?
Or no, like, working in a nursing home. That's a fascinating job.
When I was doing comedy, I wrote a pilot for an animated series called Golden Years.
Right.
Where it was about this old folks home, but it was mostly about the staff that was working behind the scenes. And I really wanted to do something with that. But on the subject of comedy.
It can be difficult to sell that.
Yes.
Why? Because nobody wants to hear from old folks.
Well, that's the whole thing is it's you think it's going to be about the old folks, but it's really about the staff.
Yeah, no, I think you made the right move there. you know, just make it yourself.
Yeah, that's
just
true.
Just the only way to get stuff made now is just make it yourself.
Yeah, and then just put it on.
There's got to be a way. There's got to be a way to animate it cheaply and shoot a couple scenes like South Park guys did originally.
Yeah, you know, just cardboard story. Or whatever. Fiverr. I'll just hire someone on Fiverr.
There you go.
Yeah. But I wanted to talk about comedy because obviously you came up through comedy and you wrote on Seinfeld for years. Mm-hmm. But initially you started at, you told me, Berklee School of Music.
Yes.
I didn't know that at all. That's crazy.
By the way, it was Patrick Long that crashed, not Peter. I don't know why I was thinking about Peter, but it was Patrick Long. I just want to correct that for everybody.
How did you transfer from Berklee to writing comedy? And what were you studying at Berklee, by the way?
Music production and engineering.
Yes.
The study of setting these up and then doing this.
Yeah, your Sennheisers and your...
There's some people who love doing that. For me, it was a cop-out.
Yeah.
Because I was terrified of becoming a music teacher. Not that there's anything wrong about that, but I had my eyes set on worldwide guitar fame. I thought I was Jimi Hendrix.
Yeah.
Or the... new Jimi Hendrix. And I wasn't. I clearly wasn't. So here I am at Berklee College of Music. I'm diving into MP&E. I'm writing. I'm film scoring. And none of it it's starting to not feel right because none of it was my primary focus. At the same time, I was bartending to kind of put myself through college.
Yeah.
Back when you could
get your gift of gab.
Back when you could bartend to put yourself through college, ladies and gentlemen.
Not anymore.
I just got that college bill for my high school senior. But you could, in theory, do this and pay off. It's insane. Yeah. Your tuition. Anyway, I was obsessed with David Letterman. And they had hired a new hostess to come in. And she was wearing the Letterman varsity jacket in Boston.
Yeah.
And I said, can I have the jacket? She said, no. And I said, how about an internship at Letterman? She goes, I'll see if I can work that out. And she did.
That's
awesome. She got me an internship. And I went back to Berkeley and went to the head of MP&E. And I said, look, this falls way outside of the category of what I study here. But I'm going to do this. Can you say that I'm going to get college tuition for it, because they need to
ensure. Oh, you were trying to get credit for
college credit.
Yeah.
Can you say they're going to get college credit? Because otherwise, they can't get the insurance that covers me as an intern, blah, blah, blah. He did that. And I never went back.
That's awesome.
I started bartending, I think, Mondays and Tuesdays, double shifts. And then I would get on Big Apple Air for $29 student flight cost and fly from Boston to New York. I would sleep on my friend's Brooklyn floor in a sleeping bag, and I would stay and work for free for Saturday Night Live, and then take the train back at 3 a.m. from Port Authority Saturday night after the party.
That's something you can only do when you're, 21 years old?
Yeah, and I loved every second of it.
Yeah.
I knew I was exactly where I needed to be when I was at 30 Rock and around that show. I was just like, this is the only place I want to be. I just knew it was for me.
That's awesome. That's awesome going from, like a program that you're viewing as a cop-out, something you don't really want to commit to knowing exactly what you want to do.
Yeah. Well, it was really David Letterman's show that was the beacon, the lighthouse, you know.
So you were saying SNL?
Yeah, but here is something you probably don't know. The graphic department of 30 Rock handled those two shows.
Oh.
So I went to work for the guy who ran graphics for those two shows.
That's cool.
This is, pre-internet. So if there's a joke about, Richard Nixon in Weekend Update or in Dave's monologue and some, I was the guy that went to AP, which is right around 30 Rock, or UPI, and went through file drawers and looked for the right shot of Richard Nixon looking confused from old photos. And I'd go, huh, and I'd take that. I'd run back to the graphics department. They would shoot it with the paint box.
Yeah.
And they would turn it into the graphic that would be over the shoulder for the joke.
That's crazy.
After the writers approved it. That was how we did things.
Wow.
Yeah, it was insane. Really crazy. Amazingly fun job. But every once in a while, you'd run into things like, I remember there was a picture of Snoopy, with the football doing something. And I'm like, how am I going to get that? And you go to bookstores, you can't find it. I went to the public library and I found all the Snoopy books and I just tore the page out and put it in my jacket and ran back and I went, it was fun. It was so fun.
That's awesome. So you mentioned Associated Press had their own box of licensed photos or something?
Yeah, that they use for news.
And so when you would take a photo out and shoot it, then you had to pay royalties for...
Frequently, we didn't do any of that stuff. Okay. I didn't handle the money.
Okay. You don't have to deal with that.
The guy I worked for handled all that stuff. But yeah, you'd have to go, all right, well, there was a State of the Union address the week before. They're going to have a file of pictures now in this giant drawer. So, are there any close-ups of the president doing this or talking afterwards? So you'd go flip, 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 flip.
So that's your foot in the door.
Foot in the door, yeah. I was doing that. And going to McDonald's for the graphic department and also getting Bud Tall for the graphic department around 4 o'clock every day. I'm not kidding.
Yeah.
This, whatever you asked me, that's what I did. I was a gopher.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was a gopher.
But because of that, because you're doing so many different things for them, they probably trust you and give you more responsibility eventually down the line or no?
When they use the picture that you found, you get pretty excited.
Yeah.
Right. You're like, oh man, I just affected Saturday Night Live. I contributed in some way. And that was the beginning of my insanity. Then I was like, I thought all of this stuff was improvised.
Yeah.
I thought David Letter, Weekend Update, this guy was, I really thought that. And they go like, no, there's a team of writers. And I go, what do they get paid? And they write these things? I think I could do that. So I started, you know, I would go home at night after work and I would write pages of jokes and then present them to whomever on whichever show, and stuff started getting done. Stuff started getting in the show.
So you were never looking at it from like, I have to do comedy to get into writing. You were like, oh, I think I can do that. I'm going to try to do that. And then you just kind of impose your will on them.
It was really about the intern staff on the original Late Night with David Letterman.
Yeah.
If I'm in college, why can't I be one of those? And mm-hmm. it was the pursuit of that that kind of went sideways into Saturday Night Live, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
And then bounced back to Letterman intern and then went from Letterman intern to Letterman writer.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
That's a cool arc.
But it was just this feeling that I think I belong there.
Yeah.
Because I know I'm not... I don't belong in music anymore. And I didn't really pay attention in school. So I can't get a real job. I'll die if I'm in an office, but I feel at home with these people.
Yeah. Were you talking to, what was his name? Paul, the band leader?
Paul Schaefer?
Paul Schaefer.
No, I know Paul, but what do you mean talking?
I mean, were you like, you weren't trying to work that angle as well, where you're like, if your guitarist gets sick, let me sub in for you.
No, I was never that good that I wanted to do that. No, I was always talking to the writers.
Yeah.
Like I had zeroed in on all of the great writers for SNL and Letterman. And it was just like, I just want to be like you guys, Steve O'Donnells and those folks, the people who invented the top 10 list, and George Meyer on SNL and Jack Handy.
Jack SNL. Handy.
Yeah. Great guys like that. And like, how can I learn about how, you know, and Dana Carvey too. You brought up Dana Carvey. Like Dana would be like, can you get footage of George Bush? I want to do an impression of George Bush. And I go, okay. And he goes, sit down. Let's work on this. And I go, work on it.
That's so cool.
And I, just to be clear, what I did was just press play and stop.
Yeah.
And he would go, okay, I'm going to exaggerate this. I'm going to try that. And it was fascinating, like seeing him build a character, right? Yeah. You know, so, you know,
that's like experiential stuff.
That's comedy college.
Yeah.
Those two shows. That's what awesome. It was. Yeah.
Have you always considered yourself a funny person?
No, not even now. Seriously. No, not at all.
Not even when you're bartending, you're like honing your chops.
No.
Trying to pick up women or anything?
No. I think about God like, oh man, I had so much going on back then. I really wish I had tried to pick up women. I really, don't you wish you could go back and go, oh wow.
Yeah.
Just God, I'm writing for these shows and God, wasn't someone saying they wanted to set me up with a model that's on the cover of this? And I said, no, I don't go on blind dates. I go, am I a f***ing... But I was wholly obsessed with the business itself.
Yeah.
Like, I remember my friend John Fortenberry, he wanted to be a director, I wanted to be a writer. We were just trying to find ways to have all-nighters at Broadway Video, Lorne Michaels' company, just so we could say, yeah, we just did an all-nighter.
Yeah.
You know, we just wanted so badly to be part of this great thing that we would just pretty much live there.
Well, you hear about those after parties, the SNL after parties.
Yeah. I used to work the door.
As crazy as they sound?
No, they're all cool. There were some fun moments, you know, here and there. You know, it's where I saw Lauren dance funny that inspired the little kicks. You'd have your moments with Madonna or someone.
Yeah.
Or you know, I remember some of the interns were smoking weed with Cypress Hill, and you're like, oh, that's pretty cool. And pulled out a joint that was this long. Damn. And they're like, okay, guys, well, you're in a restaurant, but have fun. But they were all, you know, it was a place for everybody to kind of relax and let their hair down. And I worked the door that first year, which, you know, the power went right to my head.
Yeah.
Who I'm letting in and who I'm not letting in.
That's so funny.
Yeah, yeah. And then the president of the network famously came out of that first party at 3 a.m, drunk, and then right over the hood of his town car, slid like this and got into the car. And I went, who is that? They said, that's the president of the network.
NBC. Getting and driving away?
No, it was a town car. But he ran out screaming with a girl, having fun, drunk, and then, you know, did that TJ Hooker slide over the hood and got in. And I was like, who's that? And they said, the president of NBC, Brandon Tartikoff. And I went, I am in the right place.
Yeah.
If that's what's going on at this company.
That's the ceiling right there.
Just the whole culture of what's going on before General Electric buys NBC and ruins mm-hmm. the whole vibe in its current state.
So during this time, you're in New York. You're probably not thinking about cars, right?
No, I was.
You were?
Yeah. No, absolutely. I couldn't afford a car. But when I went to work for David Letterman, it was like, you know, part of the deal we had when we moved from 30 Rock to CBS to Ed Sullivan was we got cheap parking at the Sheraton across the street.
So you actually did have a car in New York?
Well, I had a CJ5.
Oh, nice.
When I had a little extra money, I had a Jeep CJ5. I put on, you know, kind of like the fabricated bumper you guys showed me.
Yeah.
I took a 2x4 and I bolted that to the front of the CJ5. And then I put fishing pole holders, three of them, on the passenger side, 1, 2, and 3. And I would drive out to Long Island and go fishing.
Oh, that's awesome.
So I'd have I'd put my pole holders on it. I'd get out onto the beach and I'd chase bluefish and striped bass, which was fun.
Yeah.
And then I'd come back. I'd park the car Sunday night. And Monday morning, I'd wake up and everything would be stolen out of the car again.
God.
The radio and the cheap speakers. And I'd start over.
Oh, my God.
I'd work all week and then get a new radio and put it in and then head back out.
Was it a soft top?
Yeah.
Oh, so you were...
I bought it from a fireman, a Brooklyn fireman, I remember.
You were not having fun in the winters then.
No, it didn't matter. I had been driving a motorcycle in Boston in the middle of winter, a ZX600, you know, Kawasaki Ninja. Mm-hmm. So this was an upgrade. But this was the Jeep that I then put, let's see, I had that parking spot at the Sheraton. No, this predates that. So... We didn't have the Sheraton thing. This is NBC 30 Rock years, and I needed a place to park it because people kept stealing everything that was in it because it didn't lock, and it had a soft top, and it had rips. Mm-hmm. So I put it in this really cheap parking lot on the West End Highway, and I would come out to grab it on a Friday, and I'd find used condoms in it, and I'd go, what the f*** is going on here? And I went to the guy at the booth, and he goes, you know, your car doesn't lock, and there are hookers here, and they're using it for sex. I went, what? I'm paying you, dude.
Yeah, and isn't that the security guard?
The security guard. He said, take it up with Consumer Affairs. Jeez. Now, that's literally in Seinfeld. That whole story is in Seinfeld with George. It's the same exact thing. But, you know, I was kind of entertained by the whole thing. And after that, because I had a spot, it was when I bought my first Porsche.
Oh, nice. And what was that?
I had a 74 911. In sepia brown, horrible color, 200+ thousand miles, lots of rust.
Wow.
I bought it the back of DuPont Registry, I think, for $5,800.
Not bad.
Not bad. And I loved it. And when I got that car, you know, I'd drive it. We'd drive it everywhere. We'd load it up with people on a Friday night, drive it downtown, have a good time, beat on it. But it solidified me as kind of a Porsche guy. And it was David Letterman's direction. He was like, you're a Porsche guy, whether you like it or not.
Before this, you had hated Porsches.
Yeah, I bought, you know, again, I'm a dumb kid living in New York with no overhead. And rent is super cheap, right?
Yeah.
I think my rent was $300, $400. So now I'm making some actual money at Letterman. So I'm just going to take this and buy a car. So I went to some place on 34th Street and I bought a Maserati bi-turbo.
Wow.
Total piece of shit that would break down every weekend, new sets of problems. So it was that car, I think a few thousand dollars, that got me this 74. Sight unseen, I just shipped that car down to Georgia and said, send me that 911. And I'm sure I got ripped off, right? If I'm paying like 4,000 plus that car, I get hosed. But I didn't care. I just love this car.
Yeah. Before you were telling me, mm-hmm. like when you were growing up, you hated Porsches. You never wanted a Porsche, but it was David Letterman who convinced you to drive one or just to buy one.
He let me drive his cars. It's this funny thing. Like, it was a very lonely time for car guys in the 80s, in the 90s. And by that, I mean, nobody knew that there were other guys that liked cars.
There's no internet.
There was no internet. Yeah. It was embarrassing. Like, oh yeah, I'm a car guy. I know it's dumb, but I'm a car. So, you know, when I walked into Letterman, they go, oh, Spike's a car guy, which I really wasn't. I just liked them. I didn't know much about them, kind of like now.
Yeah.
But
you know a lot about
I know about the experience of driving them, and I communicate that to kind of people like me. But Dave was like, you like cars? You like this? You know, so I'd go up and I'd be bringing monologue jokes, and he'd say, hey, look, do you see the back of Auto Week? And I'd go, no. And he goes, there's a Volkswagen Rabbit with ground effects on it. And I'm like, what's ground effects? It's like, you know, it's the air. It's the way it moves. So, you know, he kind of recognized, you know, you become like their car friend.
Yeah.
You know, and I was writing for Leno at the time.
Speak the same language.
Same thing. Jerry is the same thing. And Dave was kind of the same thing. And Dave said, you know, I'd been hired for 4 weeks and we were out for the Emmys and I wasn't nominated. But he's like, come to Santa Monica Airport and drive this stuff. And I drove a Dino that day. I drove a 356 for the first time. Wow. I drove an 88 911. And, you know, he said, you're a 911 guy. And I was like, I think you're right. You know, I don't like the type of people who drive these cars. And he goes, well, you know, you've got that wrong. They're focused driving experience. Some of these cars don't have power brakes, power steering, any of this stuff. And sometimes they don't even have a radio. But you'll like the way it feels wrapped around you. And he was right.
Did you, so when you, after driving that first 911 and then buying your first 911,
yeah,
do you feel like it was a letdown, or were you like, okay, this is meant to
no,
be?
No, I always felt at home right away.
That's awesome.
Yeah, no, I my only concern was, I think the current concerns is these goddamn things are expensive now.
Yeah.
And they weren't so bad back then. They really weren't, it wasn't a big deal.
This wasn't quite the rock bottom, but this was getting close to it.
Yeah. There were many places for you to go for a few thousand dollars.
Yeah.
Which is not like it is right now.
No. You had Ralph Barbosa and Luis on a while ago.
Yeah.
Homies of the channel, Formula Bean guys, but they bought Cayman for
I love that story.
$2,000 or something.
Three.
Like that? $3,000. And they fixed it by just like thrashing the shit out of it.
Driving it, right. Yeah. They thought he bought it with the engine blown.
Yeah. It was knocking.
And yeah, it's knocking. And he just went out and he thought he'd race this thing till it stopped. And instead it cleared up. Like, it cleared its throat. And then it was
so funny. So whatever was blocking.
Yeah. Those guys are coming back on. But I think that car eventually did break. But
I just saw a story where he drove it again and was like, and it started spewing smoke.
Yeah, yeah. But he got a good couple of years out of it.
Yeah.
Yeah, for and $3,000.
He also just put like Timu exhaust headers on it. And
seems like a bad idea.
That's what he thought. He was like, you know, you look at exhaust headers for this car and they're a couple thousand dollars.
Right, right.
And he was like, I'm just going to buy these $80 ones from China.
Wow.
And he put them on and they actually sounded amazing.
Worked.
Yeah, it worked. So
that's amazing. Yeah, I like those guys a lot.
They're super cool. Ralph was just such a blast to have on.
Yeah,
he's so fun to just... He's one of those people where he makes you mad with how funny he is.
Yeah.
Everything he says is so sparse and funny and perfect. And you're like, God damn it. Like,
don't you find it interesting, the comedy world and the car world?
Yeah.
What is that? I have a theory, but let's hear your theory.
I think... Okay, so every rock star or sports guy wants to be a comedian.
Mm-hmm.
And I think every comedian wants to be a rock star or a sports star. They
It's true.
And I think a lot of it comes down to competitiveness. Comedians are so competitive. Mm-hmm. It's insane. That's kind of what drove me out of it, was like, oh, I'll just go to the car world because the bar is way lower to be funny. if you talk to car guys that are, you know, the funniest guy
That's
in their
a good
group,
point.
They have a big head and they think they're funny, but you take them out of the car group, they're not funny at all. And
right.
So I was like, okay, I can like, I don't know that much about cars, but I can write jokes and do my research and like get into it. And I think that's what, you know, my early years at Donut, I was able to stand out because I was the funniest. I couldn't talk about specific chassis codes or whatever, but I could do my research and find my way into it.
The bar is lower.
The bar is lower in the car world.
The wide comedy in cars, that's an interesting theory. I think you're right about some of it. You're right about, I think, Like everybody I've met who's in comedy wants to be a rock star
yes.
or sports. That's yeah. exactly right. It's really interesting. But I think cars are fun and I think comedy people are fun. I think yeah. it's like could be that simple, right?
It's
that we're yeah. all kind of fun experts.
And you get to kind fun. Of like we were talking about before, like the Hogwarts school. You get to pick your
yeah.
school and then like rib on the other schools.
Yeah.
And there's like inherent comedy in that mm-hmm. as well. And I don't know. Just, yeah, I feel like a lot of people want to be Jeremy Clarkson as well.
Yeah. He's funny.
Yeah.
He writes really well.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, the car community, like you said, is much more welcoming than the entertainment community.
It
goes
feel,
back to the Smothers Brothers. When I was talking to Dickie Smothers, he said yeah. part of the reason he was into cars is because they were getting all these notes on Laughing. And, you know, they were going to get canceled and there were jokes about the war and they couldn't do this anymore. There were problems at CBS, kind of like now. The problems at CBS.
Yeah.
But they would go out into the parking lot with the crew and, you know, start looking at cars. And then they said they wanted to race. And the guy said, let us help you do that.
Yeah.
Let's bring you out to Willow. Let's help. And they couldn't believe how welcoming the car community was. I find that to be true today.
Like, yeah.
I don't care what you drive. If you're into it, you know, driving a Prius and you like it, fantastic. You know, you're part of our tribe.
Checking Allstate First could save you hundreds on car insurance. Not checking your fuel levels before driving off the grid on your road trip? Not good. You're out of gas and you're stuck on the side of the road. Great way to start off the trip. Yeah, checking first is a good idea. So check Allstate First for an auto quote. It could save you hundreds. And for fast, reliable help when you need it, add an Allstate roadside plan today. You're in good hands with Allstate. Potential savings vary, subject to terms and availability. Insurance by Allstate North American Insurance Company, Northbrook, Illinois. Roadside assistance by Allstate Motor Club, Incorporated, an Allstate affiliate. I think it's become more inclusive. I've on this show, I've talked about how gatekeepy things can be, especially yeah. when you get into the more niche communities.
Who's the worst?
Well, I'm sitting in a Porsche.
You think the Porsche people are the worst?
I think they used to be the worst.
Really?
I think the okay, let's go through.
Have you met the Mustang guys?
No, I mean, Nolan is a Mustang guy, but he's
what
so nice.
What gates are they controlling?
Well, I'm just talking about like...
like getting into what? I want to know what I can control. Because like I said, I liked working the door at the SNL
yes.
parties. What can I control here?
Well, the way that you talk about Porsches and
yeah.
your specific knowledge about everything, I can't hang like that. I'm not saying that's gatekeepy,
right.
but I'm saying
it's
the people...
It's experience, though.
I'm saying the people where you're like, oh, that's a cool car. And they'll be like, yeah, but this is better. And it's like... Okay.
Right, right.
I don't have to compare every little thing. And like, if you're putting yourself in the, you know, I'm a Dodge guy, I hate Chevys, or mm-hmm. I'm a Chevy guy, I hate Dodges. I think that's lame and limiting.
Right,
and
right.
And there's stuff to appreciate about every car company, maybe not every car, but especially every company does something cool.
Yeah.
And I think it's limiting to be like, you know.
What about Lamborghini guys?
Lamborghini guys?
Bad. Yeah.
I think
the I'm just joking.
I don't, we could go through every.
You know who the worst is?
Who?
The Ferrari guys.
The Ferrari guys kind of
I
suck.
Think the Ferrari guys are the worst.
Yeah. And if I don't.
You don't, have you ever gone to Pebble? See if you can talk your way into the Ferrari party.
There's no way.
When you look around that room, you'll go, oh yeah, I know what Spike was talking about.
Yeah.
It's like 90-year-old guys who have their orgasm face stuck to their face like this, like with 17-year-old strippers from like Alabama. That's bad.
There is a weird...
But the cars are cool. I like them.
Yeah.
Don't stop letting me drive them, please.
There is a weirdly like... kind of bigger community than I thought for supercars down in Alabama and Mississippi.
Yeah.
And
this is not an indictment of Alabama.
No,
I'm
no,
just,
no.
It's an indictment of the guys who go into the strip
sure.
joints and go, I'll take one of those. And it's like, with his orgasm face.
Just a peeled back face, hair plugs.
I saw it. I saw it with my own eyes.
Yeah.
I went,
okay.
What's that?
I'm new to Pebble Beach. I've only gone twice.
Yeah.
And
that's enough.
I've slummed it up both years. Like we're on a pretty strict budget.
Right.
We get only invited.
No, it's expensive
to,
for everybody.
Yeah.
By the way, eventually everybody stops going because of the expense.
What I liked the most was I got to drive. Like this is insane that I got to drive it, but I got to drive the tribute, the roof almost resto mod one, but it's not really resto mod. It was amazing. Yeah, one of the best experiences of my life.
Yeah.
I couldn't even really put it into words. We don't do reviews on this channel.
And did you drive it through the woods?
We went to a little bit. It was like we went through past the Quail, which is always like traffic.
Oh, right. Carmel Valley.
And then we went on PCH for a little bit and we got to open it up just enough to be like, oh my God, this is amazing.
It's great.
But one of the coolest things was like all the teenagers that camp out there.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
They're like zooming in and you know, it's kind of unassuming. Like if you didn't know what roof was, you wouldn't know what this car was.
Yeah,
you
yeah.
might just think it's a Singer or a resto mod or whatever. A bubble just came out of my mouth.
That's amazing.
That was crazy.
I was enjoying it.
But we drive past.
He's frothing at the mouth.
Every single one of them turn around and like zoom in.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh man, this is cool that like this new generation knows what roof is and enough to appreciate this new.
It was crazy last year. I'm not going back this year, but last year was like pinnacle craziness.
Yeah.
Kids coming out of the woods like deer at
night
being spooked and car shows going on in weird places.
Yeah, we had
car spotter kids are all over the place.
But then I saw these TikToks of people being like, broccoli head teenagers are ruining car week. And it's like,
they're not the ones ruining it.
Yeah.
I would say the money grabs are the ones ruining it.
Can you name anything specific without pissing anyone off?
Well, yeah, it's not hard. Everybody knows it. Like, you know, all the hotels don't want to let you self-park anymore. They want you to valet because they want to take that money. That means you get stuck on the outer street waiting to come into your own hotel.
Yeah.
You know, it's stuff like that. Then there's a bunch of, not just the Lamborghini guys, but a bunch of people hooning around in a place that the people that live there year round don't want that.
Yeah.
It's overmanaged. The police shut down so many roads that you can't get anywhere. You know,
it's really hard to get
around. It's kind of, it's so successful now that too many people kind of cram into the peninsula and you can't quite enjoy it. So it's Disneyland on a day where there are too many people there.
Yeah.
And you're waiting in line for a really long time. So it's not the Concours or the events that are really at fault. It's just that it's, and I don't know how to solve this. I just know how to complain about it. But you gotta stop people. You could cut it in half and it would be just fine. Like by comparison, Audrain Concours, which is shortly after, still has a ton of people, bunch of great events, and it's very low key and quiet. And people aren't trying to grab you at every parking lot, every sandwich and the rest of it going, oh, cheeseburgers are $100 this weekend. You want to store your car for the weekend? That's $4,000 up a pebble. It's like insane, you know, and it becomes at some point you just like, I don't want to be a part of this anymore.
Yeah.
So, you know, these days I say go to Audrain. You'll see great stuff. You'll have great events. You can walk to a lot of it and it's all very relaxed.
That makes sense.
Car spotter kids who aren't really a problem aren't there, but you know, I don't mind them. They're just enthusiastic about car photos and stuff.
That's my angle. It's like, that's the new generation. Why shouldn't they be excited about it?
Exactly. Because the people who run these Concours are always like, how do we get the next generation involved? And
then they come.
They always go, they say the same thing. Let's have driving simulators. And you always go, no, they're already here, man. That's them. Let them in. Why don't you have a modified car? Why don't you have something 5,000 or less modified or something? You know, you see the success Lemons is having. Why don't you bring that into your event somehow and recognize these folks? Because that's going to happen anyways. So Rod Emery, for example, like he was telling the story about how outlaw 911s, outlaw Porsches, not only were they not allowed at the concourse for Porsche events, they would park them way in the back of the parking lots. But now eventually they had an outlaw segment at Pebble Beach. You know, they finally made their way in. So, you know, it's a good example of where this stuff is going, you know?
Yeah. I don't position myself to be like a Pebble Beach expert, but I definitely felt underdressed. I felt kind of unwelcomed, even though everyone knew Donut Media.
Yeah, yeah. But that's the experience for everybody, I think.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You're not welcome there because I felt that way at Villa d'Este. I had someone I know.
I don't even know what that is.
Villa d'Este is a show in Italy that's like Pebble Beach,
but on a
different level even of luxury, like, but it's real old money.
Old European money.
And people were like, the guy literally said, what are you doing here? just like that. And I went, I know, right? He had one of those names, Rockefeller name, one of those names. Sure. But that's just the vibe of those places. But I think Audrain is the most approachable. I don't think you'll feel that when you go there. It's like the Northeast and, you know, it's just other car fans and it's mostly working class. So that's okay.
That's cool. Yeah, we wanted to disrupt Pebble Beach. That was one of our video ideas. By dragging our crashed Porsche. I don't know if you know this, but we bought the cheapest Porsche you can buy on Bring a Trailer. And it was $850. Wow. It was,
what was it?
I think 79 SC. I don't really know Porsche.
That's a good deal.
But it was crushed from a landslide.
I get it.
Yeah. So we talked to Magnus and he was like, oh, there's always a way to bring, there's always, where there's a will, there's a way. I think it's beyond. But we wanted to drag that up there and
you fix it then, Magnus. Yeah. I don't want to deal with this.
Yeah. He did. I really like my conversation with Magnus was really illuminating because he doesn't buy anything new. You know, he restores everything. Mm-hmm. And that kind of made me reconsider what I do, you know, with clothes and stuff and furniture and just there's so much waste in this world. And if I can just salvage something and not buy something new, then I'm going to start doing that. You know, I don't know if you feel the same way.
I think it's a sound idea.
Yeah. You like all these old cars. I like old cars. There's no question in there. I just, this is free form.
The funny thing about these old cars is you trick yourself into believing that these are yours, but they're not. They will outlive you and they will continue moving forward. And
it's like a parrot.
We take that seriously. Like me and Zuckerman and Jerry, we take that whole idea seriously. Like what can we do to this? So as it moves forward through time, we at least didn't hurt the history of where it was. And, you know, I think it's so dumb, the caretaker phrase, but you know what, we did it with the Zagato, 356. You know, Zagato built it. It wasn't right. We put some money in it. We made it perfect. And then, you know, we showed it around. And now, you know, my pitch to Zuckerman was on this Plan Z was, because there was that disappointment when it was delivered and the guys at Zagato didn't do the mechanical stuff right. I said, if we get it right, it lives on forever. Yeah. Don't forget that. So we can be the guys that actually put this beautiful creation, get it right so it can drive right. Yeah. And then we'll be part of that history moving forward.
That's a cool philosophy.
I like that idea. Yeah.
You're like stewards instead of owners.
That's so dumb too. Stewards. Stewards is a dumb word. Steward. Do you know anybody named Stewart? I know a guy named Stewart.
I know one guy named, he's 6'9".
Yeah. Yeah. There's some good stewards.
Yeah.
S-T-U-A-R-T.
Yeah. But I mean, sitting in this garage is humbling because I feel like this is
what getting hurt buys you at Costco.
this is all lawsuit
money.
This
is what happens when you're in an Uber and they crash. Yeah. He takes human misery and he turns it into profit, not just for the person, but for himself.
Yeah.
It's impressive.
Well, he's helping people.
He's definitely helping people. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. He helps people all the time. All the time.
Going back to where you made your money.
Yes.
Seinfeld.
Were we there?
So you went from SNL to Seinfeld.
Yep.
How did that happen?
Oh, wait. Did I? No. I went from SNL as the receptionist.
Yes.
The guy who answered the phones to Letterman for 5 years. And from Letterman then on to Seinfeld.
How did you cut your teeth at Letterman, though? Was it intimidating jumping into that writer's room?
Oh, totally. Yeah, yeah. But you know, it was the older writers that kind of help you out and take you under their wing. Tom Gamble, Max Prost, George Meyer, all those guys.
Was there no like competitive like standoffishness with them?
With writers?
Yeah.
Well, once I get into the rooms, they were very competitive, but only in that you were trying not to get fired, you know? So you had these quarterly contracts, which were 13 weeks long, and it stipulated that at 9 weeks, they could fire you.
Oh, wow.
And then you would ride out the rest of it. So you were always competitive with, I was competitive with myself. I wanted to make sure I was delivering so that never, that clause was never triggered. And I don't think I relaxed for about 3 years and thought, all right, I don't think I'm getting fired.
How is that for your blood pressure?
It's good. It's motivational. Fear. I like fear. It motivates me a lot. Yeah. Yeah, I use it now. Not in this interview, but I like, for some reason, I'm very good at conjuring up a worst case scenario for myself. And I'll be living in a shopping cart on the street outside the door here instead of inside here talking with you.
Poverty is my biggest motivator.
I think it's a lot of people's right now, thanks to our government. But it can be turned into a power to motivate you to get things done.
Yeah.
To wake up and, you know, do the work and, you know, try, you know, don't fuck around, you know.
Yeah.
And so, you know, that was always how I thought. And, you know, if I'm looking back at now 35 plus years in entertainment, I've never not felt that way. It's a big motivator. And occasionally it works out and it's great. It's kind of like racing. You're like, wow, that thing exploded. The Soup Nazi. Wow, we're talking about it today.
Yeah.
But it was,
your joke?
I'll show you a big bag of shit that never got made that I really love too. That's kind of the way this career works. Yeah, that's an episode I wrote.
That's awesome.
Because I was going to the place when I was at Letterman. Yeah. I came in and I told Larry and Jerry the story and they were like, that's an episode. And I went, okay, that wasn't awesome. A pitch, but great. And here we are. So, you know, again, like if you're a creative, you just want to create and you never know what's going to pop. So just keep making things.
That's awesome. That's great words to live by. What's your hottest take?
Well, people are a little upset with the Ferrari Luce take that I guess that I had, which was pretty simple. Like, you know, it's really expensive, but I think it's going to work. And I'll tell you why, because it's not the only car they sell. And I don't know why people are so upset, but I understand that it looks more like an iPhone than less like a Ferrari. I think it's kind of irrelevant. I think it's going to do well. And furthermore, I kind of like the way iPhones work, and I'm kind of excited to see how that interior works. I like the way the key goes down. I like the tactile switches and the rest of it. And I think the car will work because the guy who's going to buy it has 6 Ferraris already. And he's going to go, sure, get me one of those so I can drive around in it. And I don't think any of us really expected it to be the flagship of Ferrari, right?
I mean, pretty crazy.
They're going to put a manual gearbox in the, you know, in their latest, what car, the C12. Is that the car?
Yeah, the Cilindri.
Right. Yeah. They're talking about doing that. It's all the new cool stuff that they're doing that we're all excited about. The new Testarossa. That's another hot take. I think it looks really cool.
I like it.
People hate it. They're like, I can't believe you think that looks cool. And I go, I don't. I think it looks exotic and I want it to be different. And I want it to have a provocative look like that.
Well, there's very little room to improve the original Testarossa. So why would you try to make it look exactly the same?
Yeah. And it looks a little like it, but again, it's like it's all that stuff. Like I really don't understand the pushback on the Luce. Like maybe it's that people are, you know, I was accused of losing, you know, they're going to take away my allocations. I'm like, I don't have any. I don't have a Ferrari.
They don't send you Ferrari press cards?
Yeah, they do. But our show is built on we're going to say whatever we want. Yeah. So I don't like to complain that much. So I'll say no to manufacturers and go, if you give me that, or if I drive it and I'm like, oh boy, sometimes just to be fair, I go, take this back. It's not right yet.
Yeah.
You don't want me to say what I'm going to have to say about
it. So you're like, if you have enough criticisms, you just won't even post a review of it?
I don't review so much as I tell people like what it's like to drive it around LA for a week, for better or for worse. And we don't pull punches ever, you know, and no one's ever pushed back on that. And what I wouldn't do is take something I know I'm going to hate and then have to really destroy it. Because a lot of people worked really hard on it, or you know, the company, you know what I mean? I just feel bad about ruining a car like that, but I won't take it and lie about it for the benefit of that company.
That's why I could never, you know, Jeremy Clarkson did it very elegantly sometimes where it was funny enough that what, even if he was tearing a car apart, you were like, okay,
that's
really funny. Like,
I like that too.
But a lot of people try to do that and it just comes off like really
mean. Well, you gotta know how to write. Yeah.
That's where it all circles back to like car guys thinking they're funny and it just not coming off as well as they thought.
Yeah. Sometimes they act you know, someone told me the other day they felt there's a good portion of the car community that might be on the spectrum.
Oh, and I believe that.
And that when you get something wrong, no matter how small it is, that infuriates them.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which is why I always go out of my way to go, I'm not a journalist, automotive journalist. Mm-hmm. I'm an enthusiast. And I'm having people on the show to learn more about cars.
Yeah.
And that's why Johnny Lieberman is there. And he makes mistakes too. But he's one of our experts. Or you guys come on and you know your lane very well. And you can educate me about it. That's always been our point of view on the show. And we can tell you about collecting, about buying and selling. I can tell you what it's like when you try to put your wife in a Gunther Works F26 for dinner and what car she picks instead.
Yeah.
And some of the ups and downs of buying and collecting or buying at auction and just our experience, right? That's all we're communicating is really our experience with this stuff.
That's awesome. Yeah, I think going about it from like I can learn from my guests' point of view.
Yeah, yeah.
Is how I try to approach everything because I'm, you know, I think the most relatable thing is people being vulnerable at how much they don't know.
Right.
And being honest and authentic about it.
How can you be expected to know everything?
I know.
Other than Jay Leno, how can you be expected to know everything?
And I think that's what being on the internet too much can produce
yeah,
is like,
yeah.
You know, if you have Google at your hands, of course you know everything.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're having a conversation with someone at a car meet or something,
mm-hmm.
It's better just make a friend, you know, just like
yes.
Talk about what you don't know and let them educate you. And then there's this old anecdote from apparently someone hated Benjamin Franklin so much that they were like political enemies or something.
Interesting.
And the way that Benjamin Franklin got him to like him, Benjamin, was he asked him for help and he asked him for information about something and that got the guy to get his guards down.
Yeah, now I'm important.
Yeah. And I think
it's a good trick.
Posing yourself as an expert on something makes you unapproachable in a lot of ways.
I think so.
So I'm happy that you let me in here and let me ramble and had me on your show as well. I'm at no means an expert on anything.
That's very clear. Joking. <You're> just joking.
Well, Spike, thank you much. Thank you so much for being on Talk Dog Nation. This has been a really fun conversation.
Thanks for suggesting the collab. I'm big fans of donuts, so this is exciting.
We're pretty much neighbors. We're like a 20-minute drive. So if you ever want to come drive our cars and our broken Subarus for a week or
absolutely.
Something, please don't be a stranger. Come by the office, do something with us. We could collab on something.
Anytime, man.
Show Nolan how to write a Seinfeld episode.
Yeah, let's do it.
Yeah.
All right.
Check out Spike's Car Radio. And if you want, buy one of these cars behind me. Is everything for sale? Or?
If you asked Zuckerman, he would say yes, but not everything's for sale.
Yeah.
We do have a dealership now, Morris Solomon's, purveyors of fine automobiles. And we're putting up a website and we're going to pick 5 cars. Some will be ours. Others will be cars we just find. And we're going to put them up, help people sell cars. We don't know where that's going to go, but we're excited about it.
Great. We'll check that out. And is there anything else you want to plug?
Nope.
Cool.
That's it.
Well, check out Spike's Car Radio and check out Talk Talk Nation every 2 weeks. I'm your host, Joe Weber, and it's been a pleasure. See you next time.